Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guests, and I could not have a more impressive guest than William J. Perry, who has been what one might call a defense intellectual. He started as a brilliant mathematician here at Stanford in Silicon Valley, where we're recording this, and he worked on original anti-ballistic programs and had a long history. He worked in the Carter administration. He ended up being Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration. And we are conducting this interview on, you know, a very significant day. It happens to be the 72nd anniversary of the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but this is to the day that the bombs were dropped on Nagasaki. But it's also a day in which the President of the United States, Donald Trump, has made some very startling statements about the ring of fire and so forth, that he will bring down the bear on North Korea should they make another belligerent statement. And I guess I would like to begin by asking you, you know, how did we get to this point that we seem to be at the maybe the even a higher point of danger than the Cuban Missile Crisis?
We stand today, I believe, in greater danger of a nuclear catastrophe than we faced during the Cold War. And I can explain why I believe that, but the first point I want to make, though, is that hardly anybody understands that, and because we don't understand it, our policies are not responsive to those dangers. During the Cold War, at least, we understood the danger and and taken action to try to deal with them. We had very serious arms control discussions, for example. Today, it's so far in the background that people don't understand it at all, particularly the new generation of people who didn't live through the Cold War. But it's a very dangerous situation today. And the headlines, which are about North Korea, just emphasize the danger. But the greater danger, really, is the ultimate danger, is some sort of a exchange between the United States and Russia today. That would lead not just to a great catastrophe, it would basically lead to the end of civilization. So that's what's at stake here, ending our civilization. And the nuclear weapons have the power to do that.
So let me examine this relation to Russia and how we got to this point, because you were in the Clinton administration, and that followed the first Bush administration. And first President Bush came in with the end of the Cold War, and Gorbachev was in power in what remained of the Soviet Union, and then that changed. And there was a great deal of optimism in which, in fact, Vladimir Putin has actually referred to that. He thought that Gorbachev was naive, is the word he uses. But there was a certain idea that now, I remember with the first President Bush, he thought we could cut the military budget by 30% or 40%, that this was going to be a new era of peace. And certainly on the Russian side, there was that sort of optimism. How did we get to this point now? And one thing that Vladimir Putin points out is NATO expansion. And you actually were a critic of the expansion of NATO up to the border of Russia. And yet you were part of an administration, you were Secretary of Defense administration, that seemed to push that policy.
When the Cold War ended, everybody who had lived through it, certainly myself, breathed a huge sigh of relief. We thought the danger of a nuclear catastrophe was finally behind us. And for about 10 years, that seemed to be the case. During the time I was secretary, for example, we worked very closely and very cooperatively with Russia. Together, Russia and the United States, working cooperatively, dismantled 8,000 nuclear weapons. And we saw that just as a first installment in a much greater dismantlement of weapons. We had the Russian defense minister attending NATO meetings. We had Russian troops participating in peacekeeping operations. In Bosnia, for example, where NATO sent in 50,000 troops to enforce the peace in Bosnia, one of those A big component of those troops was an American division of about 22, 23,000 troops. We had a Russian brigade as a part of an American division reporting to an American general, working as part of a NATO operation. That's how close we were then, having something almost close to an alliance with Russia. So I thought we really had it in our hands then of ending this long-term enmity and ending the danger of the two great nuclear powers being enemies of each other. But at the end of the Clinton administration, they started a process of NATO enlargement. And that was the first step towards alienating Russia from the United States. There are many other steps after that, but that was the first one. I opposed that. I argued against it to President Clinton. And when it was clear that he was going to go ahead, I asked him to call a meeting of his national security staff so I could make my case that whatever advantage there would be in doing this of enlarging NATO, it should be postponed for a few years until we had Russia more clearly on our side. In fact, we were even considering then the possibility of having Russia become a member of NATO. That's how close we were to it at that time. Clinton granted me that meeting. I made my case. I lost it. And Clinton went ahead with the enlargement anyway. That was the first step down there. The second step was in installing ballistic missile defense systems in Eastern Europe, which, again, the Russians were vehemently opposed to. Our response to Russia on their objections to these various actions we were taking basically was, what can you do about it? You're an insignificant power today. So besides doing things we didn't want, there was a humiliation aspect to it. In fact, many Russians refer to the decade of the 90s as their decade of humiliation. And the reason Putin is so popular in Russia today is that he has taken actions which allow Russia to stand, in their view, as a great power and have overcome this humiliating position they were in. He has, in effect, answered the question, what can Russia do about it? He has taken action. We don't like the actions he took, but he has taken them in response to our question, what could you do about it? So I think we started off this series of actions which alienated the United States and Russia. In the last 10 years or so, Putin has taken the actions, and some of them very dangerous actions indeed, his actions in Crimea, his actions in Ukraine, his threats to the Baltics. All of those are very dangerous actions for him to be taking. So we stand today in a position of hostility between the United States and Russia, in some ways comparable to the way it was during the Cold War. In the meantime, we both have still many thousands of nuclear weapons. And Russia has been making threats about their use of nuclear weapons, even in cases where they're not threatened by another nuclear power. So I say that the situation really is more dangerous than it was during the Cold War, because in addition to those threats, we also have the danger of a regional nuclear war in Pakistan or in North Korea. And we have the possibility of a nuclear terror attack. Neither of those occurred during the Cold War. So the possibility of a nuclear catastrophe today is certainly greater than it was during the Cold War.
And because we have so much of now with Donald Trump, a partisan politics where the Republicans are, at least at the presidential level, are considered to be irresponsible and, you know, extremists, and the Democrats are offered as a rational force. What's confusing to me about that earlier period is that here was the first President Bush, a man of considerable experience. He'd been, you know, ambassador to China, he'd been head of the CIA, and had been a veteran in a real war. He was there when the bombs were dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the president. And he came in, and to give him his full credit, this guy, President H. Walker Bush, really believed this was time for a new era. And he was going to do what General Eisenhower, as president, had called for, which was reining in the military-industrial complex and develop a new understanding of the world and its dangers and so forth. And then under Bill Clinton, you had what I still cannot understand, and I interviewed the man at different points, but I still don't understand what was the reason for this heightened sense of sort of a cold war. I mean, yes, you had terrorism, you had other problems in the world, you had poverty, mm-hmm. you had instability, you had the proliferation of nuclear weapons and so forth. There are a lot of real issues, but why expand a Cold War alliance? Yeah.
Let me, first of all, give Bill Clinton his due on this. The policies that George H.W. Bush pursued, beginning with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, were, I think, very appropriate policies. which included reaching out to Russia, a hand of friendship. That actually began in the Reagan era, but it continued on with President Bush. And Clinton did extend that. He reached out the same hand of friendship to Russia. It also, I think importantly, included the significant decrease of our military capability. Our military size, I should say, not capability. President Bush began a program, which was followed by Clinton, of reducing the size of our military. And the plan was to reduce it by one-third, which is a pretty big cut. That was, in fact, implemented during the 4 years of the Bush administration and the first 4 years of the Clinton administration. I was secretary at the time, and I picked up basically what President Bush had started and continued it on for another 4 years. And so over those four-year periods, we reduced the size and the expenditures of the military about 4% a year, which over 8 years amounted to about one-third. That stopped after I left office, and we military held level for a while, and then started to come up again in recent years. But that was, in fact, done, and it was done by President Clinton as well as by President Bush. And it was done, I think, orderly and effectively. That is, I think it was done without reducing the readiness of our forces. At the time I left office as secretary, I believed we had a highly capable and ready military force, but a force that was one-third smaller than it was during the Cold War, appropriately so. For example, we had pulled nearly all of our troops back out of Western Europe. We had had several hundred thousand there during the Cold War. So there's a big reduction in forces and big savings in the defense budget. That has since been turned around, but that was effective over both the Bush administration and the first term of the Clinton administration.
In your book and other writings, you seem to be very clear that you actually cannot do nuclear war fighting and that defense doesn't work. And I want to, since we're at Stanford, I want to bring up an incident that I happened to be in the arms control seminar that Sid Drell had, and Condoleezza Rice mm-hmm. was there before she became Secretary of State. And at one point, I encountered Edward Teller when I came up here at the airport, and I knew him, and I had interviewed him, and he said, "Oh, you're going up to see Sid Drell," he said, at the Arms Control Center. He said, "Make sure Sid tells you about the great results we had on the cottage test." And, in the cottage, I wasn't even supposed to know the cottage test was about nuclear weapons testing or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Did you get lasing?" Because I knew they were trying to get an X-ray laser. And he said, "Yes, but make sure Sid tells you about it." Well, for one thing, in terms of classified information, I thought this was like probably the biggest, if it was true that they developed an X-ray laser that they could shoot down all kinds of things, it would change the whole nature of nuclear war fighting. And then when I got up there, I said to Sid Drell, I said, "Edward Teller told me you're going to tell me all about it." He said, "No, what are you talking about? You know, you can't talk about any of that." And it turned out they didn't get the lasing. It turns out the explosion had hurt the instruments or something, so they really didn't get this breakthrough. But Teller believed, and he convinced Ronald Reagan, that you could actually develop a shield. You don't believe that, and you don't believe we've ever been able to do that.
I didn't believe that then, and I stated very clearly I didn't believe it then, and I don't believe it now. In general, I think it's not possible today or any time in the foreseeable future to build a defense which provides reasonable confidence you can defeat a large-scale nuclear attack. You might be able to defeat a few missiles being fired at you with some confidence, but not a large-scale attack. Even with a few missiles, there's a possibility that the decoys which the other side will put on those few missiles will make it look like a large-scale attack, and therefore you still can't defeat it. But in general, I think that the belief that we can defend our country against a large-scale attack is a fantasy. And it has led us to not only spend billions and billions of dollars needlessly, but it has led us to policies based on the belief that we can achieve that defense. The best we can say about the ballistic missile defense system we have today is, with good luck, it could defeat a few missiles being fired at us, a North Korean attack, say. Perhaps more importantly, whether or not it did that, it would have to sow a certain amount of uncertainty in the minds of the attacker, and therefore maybe deter him from making the attack. That, I think, can be said about the money we're putting in it is giving us that return, that benefit, but not much more than that. The downside of it is, beside the money we spend, is it instills a belief in people's mind that we could really defend ourselves against a large-scale attack. And that, I say, is a fantasy.
Okay, time for a break from Sheer Intelligence. We'll be back in a minute. We're back with Sheer Intelligence. And I'm speaking to William J. Perry, who has been Secretary of Defense, but also started as a mathematician, understanding these weapons and what they do, has lived his 70 years in this world. So you bring to this discussion as much knowledge as any human being possesses about these weapons, what they can do, how to deal with them.
I mean, that doesn't mean I'm always right.
No, I understand that. But I think you're also quite modest in your writing. You don't claim to always be right. But it seems to me that the real danger is, as you point out in your writing and in your book, that we've been lulled into an indifference to these weapons.
Yes.
Right? That's your basic
thesis.
And the William J. Perry project here at Stanford and the reason you wrote your book and you're out there writing columns is that you're concerned, even before Trump, because the book came out
right.
a year before Trump, that we are at the most dangerous moment, I gather, because we're less concerned about it, but also there are these other nations. We mentioned Pakistan rather casually. Pakistan, as I gather, has 80 or 100 such weapons. I don't know, but
more than 100.
More than 100. And they actually fueled the program in Iran and Korea. Mm-hmm. And yet we dropped our embargo on Pakistan in the George W. Bush administration. And we really sort of don't care very much about it anymore. And even now are talking about launching a weapon. And a question I want to put to you, and you've lived with this issue forever. We had this policy that to me I never thought it made sense, but smart people told me it did, and that was the mutual assured destruction. And Nixon sort of refined it by saying, I guess it was the madman theory. Your enemy has to think you can actually be crazy and mad. Well, we actually have a president now that I suspect many world leaders think could actually use these weapons. And it's keeping us up at night. And when we're doing this interview, as I say, it's the anniversary of the 72nd year of the dropping of the bomb in Nagasaki and a week before Hiroshima. And we have a president who many informed people in this country feel is actually capable. So first of all, I wonder if you could walk me through it. What happens when, because you've been there as Secretary of Defense and you know a lot about the Cuban Missile Crisis, you're an advisor, all of these things. Why are we still on hair trigger alert? Here Donald Trump is in the same position Ronald Reagan was in, or Clinton or anybody earlier, and certainly John Kennedy during the missile crisis, where, as you have written, we came very close to destroying civilization. Why do we still live in a world where one human being, the President of the United States and presumably his counterpart in what remains of the Soviet Union and Russia, What happens?
Well, there are a lot of questions wrapped together in what you just said there, but let me try to address it. A first point about Pakistan, which I said they have over 100 nuclear weapons. They've had three wars with India since the separation of the two countries. The issue which divide them is still there, which is the Kashmir. And therefore, they may have another war. If they have another war, it's almost sure, I think, to go nuclear. Not only would a nuclear war between India and Pakistan kill tens of millions of people in India and Pakistan, but the soot and the dust and the pollution that goes up into first the atmosphere and then the stratosphere, which would stay for years, would block the rays of the sun to a degree that we would expect a few degrees drop in temperatures all over the planet, which would have a profound negative effect on agriculture. In a nuclear war like that, there's no place to hide. Everybody on the planet would be affected. On the Cuban Missile Crisis, President Kennedy's view after the crisis was he believed there was one chance in three of that ending in a nuclear holocaust. Even with the nuclear weapons we had in those days, probably brought our civilization to an end. one chance in three. That's pretty bad odds for a result that catastrophic. And I think Kennedy was optimistic because he didn't know when he made that statement that the Soviets already had nuclear weapons on tactical missiles in Cuba with orders to use them against any attack. And he was being recommended to conduct a conventional attack against Cuba by a unanimous recommendation of his Joint Chiefs of Staff. Had he done that, our troops would have been decimated on the beachhead and the general nuclear war surely would have followed. We were that close to the end of civilization. The other point I want to make is that at this time, and this is a term that Jerry Brown has used, I think is very apt, that we're sleepwalking into a nuclear war. And he used that analogy from World War I, where historians have described how we were sleepwalking into World War I. Nobody knew, understood what the consequences were going to be. And that seems to be what we're facing now. The analogy here to World War I is much more apt than the analogy to World War II. World War II, we had somebody consciously starting the war. I mean, Hitler had a plan and a set of action, and that led to World War II. World War I, we were sleepwalking into it. That's what the danger is today. We will sleepwalk. We will blunder into a nuclear war, not because any of the leaders who have nuclear weapons are consciously planning a nuclear war. An India-Pakistan nuclear war would be a result of a blunder also, not because the two presidents want to start a war, but because something happens and it gets out of control. A minor military conflict could quickly escalate into a major war. Decisions being made by commanders in the field, not by the two presidents.
Could that happen with Korea as well?
Yes, it could. The danger of Korea, I'm going to be very clear about this. Whether or not North Korea presently has a capability to attack the United States with nuclear weapons, I think the answer to that is no, but I think they will have in a year or two. So that's not the issue. Sooner or later, they will. They are not going to do that. This regime is ruthless, it's reckless, it's abhorrent in many ways, but it's not irrational. It's not crazy.
Now, let me just stop you for one second, because somebody listening to this will say, oh, easy for William J. Perry to say, but the fact is, you are in a better position to assess the North Koreans than any human being in this country, because you actually have been there dealing with them.
I've negotiated with them, indeed. Why don't you I've give negotiated us, with them getting rid of their nuclear weapons.
So why don't you give us that background, because this statement you just made and the assessment of what is going on now is probably the most intelligently informed statement. I don't even know what you're going to say, but it's one that we should pay very serious attention to. So give us that.
I've been to North Korea three or four times. One time in particular, I was sent by President Clinton. I was out of office at that time. I was now back at Stanford. But he asked me to come back in temporarily because he had a crisis with North Korea. We seem to always be having a crisis with North Korea. I teamed up with representatives from Japan and South Korea, and we put forward a recommendation which all three of the leaders of our three countries agreed to, and then I was sent over to Pyongyang to negotiate with the North Koreans. I was there about a week with a team of American negotiators, and we came back with a tentative agreement from North Korea to give up all of the nuclear weapon programs and the long-range missile program, in return of which we did a number of things. This agreement, had it been carried out, I think we cannot relive history, cannot predict for certainty what would have happened, but certainly would be in a better position than we are today, without doubt. But in any event, before Clinton would finally get that treaty signed and negotiated, the election came and we changed presidents. And President Bush cut off all discussion with North Korea. For 2 years, we didn't talk with them at all. So that whole negotiation just went down the drain, which I think was a terrible loss. What I learned in that time I was there and talking with them was this regime is ruthless and reckless, but they are focused entirely on their own survival, the regime's survival, the leadership's survival. Survival of the Kim dynasty, that's what they're focused on. So they will not be suicidal. This is not Al-Qaeda we're dealing with. These are not people seeking martyrdom. They're seeking the sustain of the regime. We look at what they're doing today. They have failed in the negotiation to get assurances that the regime would survive, so they're trying to get them through their nuclear weapons. So they're not going to be conducting a preemptive attack on the United States or Tokyo or Seoul. They're going to use them as a threat and bluster. That's the good news. They're not going to use them preemptively. The bad news is it's still very dangerous because in this exchange of words and in this posturing and in this saber-rattling, it's very easy to imagine a small military conflict starting. And then it's easier to imagine the small military conflict escalating into a larger military conflict. Any large military conflict, any second Korean War with conventional weapons, North Korea would lose. And as they lose it, as they see the regime about to be overthrown, then in desperation they might use them. It might be sort of a Korean Armageddon. That's the danger that, again, that we would blunder into a nuclear war. In a sense, it's the same danger we have with Russia today. Not that either leader would deliberately start a war, but that we would blunder into a nuclear war, that we would sleepwalk into a nuclear war, as in the World War I model.
This rare victory happened, and it hardly mentioned in the media as significant, and that both China and Russia supported the Security
yes.
Council resolution, and the Chinese have they've said something very interesting. They said negotiations should start again, but you have to take regime change off the table.
First of all, a military solution in North Korea is foolhardy and extremely dangerous and result in millions of people being killed. Millions of people, including Americans. So we ought to do everything we can to avoid the military, which means we need to work harder on the diplomatic solution. The diplomatic solution is available, I believe, but it does require close cooperation with China. We cannot get it by ourselves, as we've demonstrated year after year. But by that, I do not mean, as we're doing, pointing to China and say, you solved the problem, and China pointing to us and say, you solved the problem. We need to be working together with China to solve this problem. In any diplomatic agreement, you need to have both carrots and sticks. We've got the carrots. We and our allies have the carrots, economic carrots, many things we can do that North Korea really wants. But we don't have the sticks. China has the sticks. They're not willing to use the sticks because they fear that we're seeking. They fear correctly, I think, that we're seeking regime overthrow. So we have to go to China quietly and carefully and thoughtfully and come to an agreement that we will pull back this threat of regime overthrow if they will cooperate with us in a putting together a diplomatic package that has both carrots and sticks. I think if we had that, we could go to North Korea and get a successful agreement.
A lot of us are focused on the instability or mental stability of Donald Trump and his rhetoric and who he is. And so what does it mean to be President of the United States in such a moment? You've been there with the president, several presidents. What does it mean that here's this Korean problem, and let's say something happens, and are we still on that hair trigger alert? How does it work? You go up in an airplane, you get the code, and is it really true that after so many years, I don't know how we got this in the first place, that one human being could make that decision? But could Donald Trump basically push a button that ends life on this planet?
Yes, he could. And the question is how we got there. We got there during the Cold War because we saw our primary capability in deterrence being through our ICBMs, our ground-based long-range missiles, and that each of them is in silos at known locations, and therefore they're subject to a preemptive attack from the other side. And so all during the Cold War, we believed that our primary way of survival, which was through deterrence, depending on being able to stop a surprise attack, prevent a surprise attack. And the way we saw of doing that was we would launch our missiles before the attack came. So we built elaborate, expensive, and very effective warning systems, which would give us about 10 or 15 minutes warning that an attack was underway. And during that 10 or 15 minutes, the calculation is made that the word is sent to the president that the attack is underway. And the president then has probably less than 10 minutes to make a decision to either launch an attack ourselves or take the possibility of losing all of his ICBMs in that he has to assume that the missiles are coming to the United States will be targeted at our ground forces, our ICBM forces. So we got to that position because we feared that the Soviet Union would make a surprise attack on us, and that the only way we could deal with that issue was to launch our missiles before the attack landed. And that involved two things: having a very sophisticated warning system, which we had then and we still have, but it also involved giving the president the unique authority to make the decision to launch, to make it in a few minutes, and to make it without necessarily any consultations with anybody else. or uncertainty that doesn't, there's nothing in the system that gives anybody the opportunity to countermand that decision. So we have today the situation where one person, the President of the United States, can give a command which nobody can override, which would launch all of our missiles, would basically start up a nuclear war, which could end our civilization.
You know, frankly, I think this is the most depressing conversation I've had as a journalist, because this many years after MAD, after the whole thing, and with a triad of forces, with redundancy, with all sorts of, and also knowing there can be false signals, that your intelligence system can be wrong, and you don't know that a President Trump, or any president, but President Trump captures one's attention, focuses one's attention, would have 8 or 10 minutes to decide whether life is going to continue. Why wasn't that changed? Why, given that we have subs, given that we have forces in the air, given that we know these technical systems can be wrong.
It hasn't been changed because many people believed that the greatest danger of the United States was a surprise attack from the Soviet Union. I think that was wrong then, and I think it's wrong now. The greatest danger is not a surprise attack. The greatest danger is that we will blunder into a nuclear war, into a war. And one example of how we might blunder into it is if, through a false alarm. We have had, in the United States, 3 different false alarms that I know of, and Russia, the Soviet Union, has had 2 different false alarms that I know of. There may be more in both cases, but that's at least 5 false alarms over about 40-year period. So that's one every eight years. In each case, we did not take the action, of course, or we wouldn't be here. But in 2 of those cases, it was very close, a very close call. The alarm looked very realistic. And so the danger is there. Humans will steal air. Machines will steal air. And so sooner or later, we're going to have another false alarm. And when we get that, then whoever's the president will have that decision to make. And it's a bad system. I have campaigned to try to get, as we rebuild our nuclear arsenal, modernize it, so to speak, that we not do that with the ICBMs. We let our ICBMs phase out, because the only real danger from false alarm comes from our ICBM forces. With the submarine forces, you can ride it out. Wait to see, make sure you're exactly right. Wait for the presumed missiles to actually strike the United States before you actually launch. With our bomber forces, we can cause the bombers to take off in orbit. But with the ICBM forces, it's use them or lose them. And the temptation to use them will be very great, which means we're taking the chance of a false alarm starting a new war. So the last message I want to leave you is that the danger today is not that one president or another president would decide to start a nuclear war. The danger is that we will blunder into a nuclear war. And the consequence of a nuclear war, particularly one between the United States and Russia, could be no less than the end of our civilization.
Well, on the 72nd anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki, that's a chilling message. And I would urge people who have been listening to this to get William J. Perry's book, which is
My Journey at the Nuclear Brink.
At the Nuclear Brink, Stanford Security Studies, and you can get it in paperback at a fairly reasonable cost. The hardcover might break your bank.
But buy the paperback.
Paperback, $24. It's, as Jerry Brown pointed out in his review for the New York Review of Books, and I really the most important book you can read and get past the headlines and understand really what we're talking about. And so I want to thank you for doing this.
Thank you, Bob.
And I want to thank our producers, Joshua Shearer and Rebecca Mooney, our technical engineers at KCRW, Kat Ure and Mario Diaz, here at Stanford Video, Dan David. And let me say, we'll have, hopefully, if our president doesn't get that call early in the morning, I'll be back with another edition of Sheer Intelligence next week.